This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Sam Harris is the author of the national bestseller, The End of Faith, Religion, Terror, and the Future of Reason. His latest book is Letter to a Christian Nation. Sam received a degree in philosophy from Stanford and is now completing a doctorate in neuroscience. The End of Faith won the 2005 Penn Award for First Nonfiction. Sam Harris joins us on the long line from New York City. How are you, Sam?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's a real honor to speak with you, and I want to thank you for taking some time to chat with us here in Virginia. Let's get right to it. We don't have all day to chat. I wish we did, but I have a million questions for you. But Sam, for people who aren't familiar with your work, what is is there a central message in your books?
Yeah, I've really been arguing in both my books that we're paying a terrible price for not criticizing all of the irrationality that goes on in the name of faith. I mean, we have this fundamental double standard in our culture where we resist irrational claims to certainty. We look down upon people who pretend to know things they clearly cannot possibly know, and especially when they're motivated by these false certainties to take actions that harm other people. We really there's no respect at all for this phenomenon, except when this occurs under the aegis of religion, except if these certainties apply to God, and especially the biblical God. What we have as a result is a world that has just been shattered unnecessarily into these competing moral communities. We have Christians against Muslims, against Jews, and these divisions in our world have become intractable because it is fundamentally taboo to criticize a person's religious beliefs. We have to respect what our neighbors believe about God because these beliefs are about God, even when they are completely uncoupled to the world of evidence and logical argument. And that's what I'm basically spelling out, how dangerous I think that is in both of my books.
Sam Harris is our guest best-selling author, award-winning best-selling author. We'll get to The End of Faith in a moment, but first, your latest book is a surprisingly slim volume. It's less than 100 pages.
Yeah.
And yet I found myself dog-earing nearly every single page. Tell us the backstory on this little book, and the title of the book is Letter to a Christian Nation. What's the motivation, and specifically, why did you address this book to American Christian fundamentalists?
Yeah, well, you know, my first book was published in the States first, and because we're a nation in which something like 83% of the people believe that Jesus literally rose from the dead, and 53% of us think that the universe is 6,000 years old, and we have no genetic precursors in the natural world apart from Adam and Eve. I mean, we're living in a country that is just brimming with Christian faith. And so much of the criticism I received in response to The End of Faith came from Christians, and very committed Christians of all different flavors, not just evangelicals, but just Christians in general. And they came to me with certain arguments in defense of God. I received thousands of emails, and I began to respond to these emails with a kind of form letter, which grew in response to some of the replies I got. And I kind of went to school on the concerns of committed Christians. And then I realized one day that I could just write a very long form letter or a very short book that would address the concerns of committed Christians as they have come to me. It's not like there are 100 arguments that people put forward in defense of God. The arguments are actually very few, and it seems to me one of the strengths of the book that it's so short, because it really is the kind of book that you can hand to someone who you know is not going to agree with it and say, you know, read this and get back to me. I mean, you can't do that with The End of Faith. It's a much longer book
and
much more of a commitment.
Let me, if I could, I'd like to read some brief passages from Letter to a Christian Nation and just have you sort of flesh them out for
us. Sure.
Excuse me. Fighting a cold here.
Yeah, I know it.
One of the most pernicious effects of religion is that it tends to divorce morality from the reality of human and animal suffering. Religion allows people to imagine that their concerns are moral when they are not. That is, when they have nothing to do with suffering or its alleviation. Indeed, religion allows people to imagine that their concerns are moral when they are highly immoral. That is, when pressing these concerns inflicts unnecessary and appalling suffering on innocent human beings.
Yeah, yeah, that really lies at the heart of the problem, I think. But one of the beliefs that is so prevalent in our culture and which keeps religion in such good standing with otherwise very intelligent and even secular people is that there's this myth that religion is somehow a good framework for teaching morality. In fact, many people think it's the only framework for teaching morality. Without believing that one of your books was written by the creator of the universe, it's believed that there's no basis, real universal basis, to treat other people well, to not rape and kill and steal. We just have moral relativism and we'll just plunge into this state of nature together. And there's no evidence for that. In fact, there's much evidence to the contrary, and I talk about that to some degree in the book. But there are very simple ways to see that this is not true. I mean, you take the Bible, for instance, and you read it, and you come to a brilliantly ethical line, like the golden rule: you do unto others as you would have them do unto you, and you recognize the ethical wisdom of that, and that's fine. But there are other lines in the Bible, like the injunction in Leviticus, that if your bride is not a virgin on your wedding night, you're to take her to her father's doorstep and stone her to death. And we now reject lines like that as being just the sheerest barbarism. And what I would argue is that we do both of these things, accepting the good parts and rejecting the bad parts of Scripture, based on our own moral intuition and based on a larger conversation about morality. So if you don't already know that cruelty is wrong, you're not going to discover it by reading the Bible, because the Bible is chock full of cruelty. And what is so dangerous about this idea that we get our morality out of religion is that it really does allow religious people to create immense human suffering in the service of their religious myth. And this one very clear example of this is you have people go to Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, countries like Sudan, to help the unluckiest people on the planet who are suffering war and diseases. And it's a very good thing that people from affluent countries do this. But there are two different kinds of people who do this. There are people who do it for secular reasons, who just want to go and help other human beings because they care about their suffering. People who work for, like, Doctors Without Borders, you know, they do this purely out of compassion. That's a very good thing. And then you have Christian people, Catholics and Christians generally, who go there for religious reasons, and they're also going there based on compassion, based out of a concern for other people's suffering, but they come freighted with these religious dogmas. And one dogma is that contraception is morally problematic and sinful, and therefore should be preached against. And you have Christian ministers literally preaching the sinfulness of condom use in areas where AIDS is epidemic and where millions of people, something like 3 to 4 million people die every year from AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa, millions of people die every year from this disease, and their only information about condom use is coming from the ministry. And so one thing I argue in my book is that this is really genocidal stupidity. This is unconscionable behavior, and yet it's not done by evil people. These are good people going to help people, but they just believe that the dogma of the Catholic Church, that contraception is a sin, and there's no rational basis to believe this, and it creates immense suffering. And that's just simply one example.
And you raised the word dogma. We're talking with Sam Harris. His latest book is Letter to a Christian Nation. In light of what you just mentioned about dogma, there's a passage from your book that reads, "It's time that Christians like yourself stop pretending that a rational rejection of your faith entails the blind embrace of atheism as a dogma. Mm-hmm. One need not accept anything on insufficient evidence to find the virgin birth of Jesus to be a preposterous idea. The problem with religion, as with Nazism, Stalinism, or any other totalitarian mythology, is the problem of dogma itself."
Right, right. I mean, this is one of the myths that is quite current among religious people. The idea that atheism is another kind of faith, that it asserts the absence of God, and that's a completely irrational assertion because you can't prove that God doesn't exist, et cetera, et cetera. Well, you know, none of us believe in Zeus, and we have not proven the absence of Zeus. The burden is not upon us to find Mount Olympus empty of invisible deities. The burden is upon any worshiper of Zeus who wants Zeus taken seriously and wants Ovid's Metamorphoses or the Iliad and the Odyssey to inform our public debate about national policy. The burden is upon the pagan to provide evidence for his invisible realities before he's taken seriously. And we all recognize that. We are all atheists with respect to Zeus. Somehow Christians imagine that the burden is upon the atheist to prove the absence of the God of Abraham or to prove that Jesus did not rise up from the dead. That's not the way the burden runs. The burden is really upon those making extraordinary claims about miracles and about the omniscience of the author of certain books. One thing I argue in my book is that if you look at the Bible dispassionately and try to assess whether it is the product of an omniscient being, you'll realize there is really no significant evidence whatsoever that it could not have been written by an inhabitant of the first century or before. I mean, there's not a single line in the Bible that could not have been written by someone living in the first century. It doesn't bear the slightest trace of omniscience. And the games that religious people play about the confirmation of prophecy, the New Testament supposedly confirms Old Testament prophecy. I mean, this is just a painting prophecy by numbers that could have been so easily done by gospel writers. I mean, it's almost like saying that there are events in the first volume of The Lord of the Rings that get confirmed in the third volume of The Lord of the Rings, and this proves that The Lord of the Rings was written by an omniscient deity. It's a laughable claim, and it would be laughable in any other context, except we have grown up with this idea that somehow it's a respectable claim to make when it's in defense of Christianity.
We really do inherit the faith of our fathers.
Absolutely.
And that's all over the world. I mean, that is any society at any level of development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's another smoking gun, really. Christians who grow up in this country and are now quite convinced that Jesus is the Son of God and coming back to Earth, it's suspicious that they believe this, living in a country where they've had Christianity drummed into them from an early age. I mean, it's not like this was arrived at on the basis of a truly independent investigation of the workings of the world. And when one thing I don't doubt, and I discuss in both my books, is there's no question that people have spiritual experiences and extraordinarily positive experiences in the context of religion. I have no doubt that people go to church and pray and feel bliss and feel a genuine transformation of their character through religious practice. But the thing is, there's a deeper principle at work here. I mean, if you are praying to Jesus 18 hours a day and you feel much better because of it, that's great. But it's not evidence that Jesus really is the Son of God, because you need only look over and see that Hindus are having the same experience, never thinking about Jesus, and Buddhists are having the same experience. At the very least, your interpretation of the data should be that it's not really about the particular a patriarch of a specific faith. There's a deeper possibility of the human mind here, and we should just talk about that rationally. We shouldn't embrace any dogma in the service of that discussion.
Sam Harris is our guest, best-selling author. His latest book is Letter to a Christian Nation. Sam, I remember before Joseph Campbell died, he had started talking about religion as a type of software.
Right, right. I think that's an apt analogy. I mean, I would think that you could extend it to much of what we do with our minds in general, and just belief in general, is a kind of software. We have software viruses. I mean, Richard Dawkins has spoken a lot about memes, which by analogy with genes, are ideas and concepts that just spread almost virally throughout a population. And the most successful ones endure. And religion has been quite successful at propagating itself. And there are features of it as a belief system that offer clues as to why it's been so successful. I mean, when you raise people to believe that certain beliefs are magical and to fail to hold them is going to lead to an eternity of suffering, those beliefs lock in rather deeply. And there are emotional barriers to challenging them, because people are really afraid of hell. I mean, for secularists who don't believe in hell, It is difficult to understand that something like 70% of their neighbors in this country really do, and it provides quite a motive, and it's a barrier to honest discussion.
On the same token, if you look at it conversely, I don't think Americans, and you've written this, I don't think Americans appreciate the depth to which a Muslim terrorist literally believes in his heaven.
Yeah. Yeah, well, this is one of the ironies about liberal discourse and secular discourse. I find that the people who are least able to understand the motives of suicide bombers and jihadists generally are liberals and moderates and secularists, because they actually don't know what it's like to be certain of God. They don't know what it's like to be absolutely convinced that the book they keep by their bedside is the perfect word of the creator of the universe. And it's ironic that the people who should be in the best position to see the dangers of religious literalism and to see how religion is unnecessarily shattering our world, in some sense are the least able to call a spade, because they just doubt that anyone believes what they say they believe. When the jihadist looks into the video camera and says, "We love death more than you infidels love life," and then blows himself up, it's the religious moderate or liberal in our society who's left thinking, "Well, that's not really what honestly what he meant. I mean, that's propaganda, or he's been brainwashed. You know, this isn't really religion," because they don't know what it's like to really be motivated by their own theology. Whereas fundamentalists in our culture do. I mean, our own fundamentalist demagogues really know what's going on in the Muslim world. They know these people are certain of paradise. They're just wrong by the lights of fundamentalist Christianity.
Best-selling author Sam Harris is our guest this hour on Charlottesville Right Now. His books are The End of Faith and Letter to a Christian Nation. Let's take a break here at the bottom of the hour for some local news and weather. You're listening to Charlottesville Right Now.
You know, our lives can change in an instant, and thanks to the Charlottesville Alamo Rescue Squad, Larry Berry of Charlottesville is alive and has a story to tell.
I was also registered to win a set of Hamilton Beach appliances, blender, coffee maker, and mixer, a winner in every branch.
I'd like to propose a toast.
To Union Bank and Trust?
No, to you for reading what follows so perfectly.
Annual percentage yield of 3% is effective for 1 year from date of account opening. After offer expires, the interest rate and terms and conditions convert to standard now account. Fees may reduce earnings. Certain restrictions apply. Account must be open with funds not currently on deposit with Union Bank and Trust. Member FDIC. Offer ends October 31st, 2006. Please hurry.
Listening to my daddy on News Radio 1070 WINA. Charlottesville, right now!
Dora!
Oh,
come on, Dora!
Oh, thank you, darling. I'll be home as fast as I can. And yes, I'm bringing the pizza. It's 64 degrees in Charlottesville right now. Partly cloudy. September 22nd, everybody. And I do hope that you have a fantastic weekend planned. We're cutting it short today. We're getting out of here at 5 so that Best Seat in the House can take over. We've got high school football tonight, Albemarle versus Charlottesville. Albemarle is trying to sweep the county, ladies and gentlemen. They might do it tonight right here on News Radio 1070 WINA. Sam Harris is the author of the national bestseller, The End of Faith, Religion, Terror, and the Future of Reason. His latest book is Letter to a Christian Nation. Sam joins us on the phone from New York City. Sam, let's talk about The End of Faith a little bit, your first book.
Mm-hmm.
Late one Friday night, I'm at home, I'm flipping through the channels, and I came across a C-SPAN, Book TV, and it mm-hmm. was a talk that you gave, and I was initially, you just don't hear people talking like that a lot on television. And so my first reaction was, here is an incredibly intelligent, well-read, insightful observation about religion. But even more than that, I'm thinking, my gosh, here is an incredibly courageous comment about religion. We live in a country where 44% of Americans think that Jesus Christ will return in the next 50 years. 22% of those are certain of that. 43% of us favor teaching creation science instead of evolution in public schools. 28% of us believe that every word of the Bible is literally true. And 87% of Americans say they never doubt the existence of God. So to go and write the things you've written and to very sensibly talk about them, whether it's on the television or on radio, I believe is courageous to call for this type of discussion. What has been the reaction that you've gotten to The End of Faith?
Well, you know, by and large, it's been just immensely positive. It's really been that's been a bit of a surprise. I would say 95% of the emails and letters I get are just utterly supportive, and from people who are just quite ecstatic to hear these views expressed so nakedly. But you know, as will be no surprise, I've gotten my fair share of angry emails, and I'm sure I'll get many more in response to this second book. You know, I guess it is. There's some level of bravery involved when looked at from the outside. I don't really feel it from the inside so much. I mean, it does seem like a slightly crazy thing to be doing, given the context. And I notice that there are many people who agree with me who are not doing what I'm doing for reasons that they would ascribe to concerns about their safety or you know, just not wanting the hassle of being. Of running, you know, into the teeth of this virtual consensus of religious dogmatism, but you know, it's not something that I'm really thinking about that much. I just find that I can't do otherwise. I keep reading the newspaper and seeing that, you know, on any given day, sometimes half of the bad news is coming by virtue of what people believe about God. It's never described as such. I mean, you can read the newspaper for months and not be reminded that the conflict between Israel and her Arab neighbors, for instance, is a religious conflict. I mean, it's continually described as a conflict over land, but the only reason why these people can't live happily on the same land is they believe incompatible things based on their religious dogmas about that land and about how people should live there. So I just see religion, I just see this downpour of unnecessary human misery born of what people believe about God. I just can't keep silent about it, at least at the moment.
And the Jews and Muslims, of course, it's not just metaphorically the same God, it's literally the same historical God.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
If they can't get along, then there's not much hope.
Yeah, I mean, that's the hope for interfaith dialogue, I think, is in the limit, you know, ultimately negligible, because, you know, as you say, you know, the Shia and the Sunni have precisely the same God, and they've been killing each other for centuries because they worship in slightly different ways.
Yeah. Sam, let's talk about what you write about Islam in The End of Faith. Much of the book deals, it really takes Islam head on. If you've said that the idea that Islam is a peaceful religion hijacked by extremists is a fantasy. How so?
Well, it's a fantasy that may need to be indulged occasionally by people like the President of the United States. You know, I'm not saying that I think the President should speak the way I speak about Islam. That would be just so inflammatory, as we see what has recently happened with the Pope and his speech. But the reality of the situation is that Osama bin Laden is not a marginal figure in the Muslim world. He's not the Reverend Jim Jones of the Muslim world. He really does stand for a terrifyingly vast constituency. We don't know what percentage of Muslims are sympathetic with his views, but it's not 1%. It's not half of a percent. I mean, it is a percentage that would terrify us. And there is a kind of death cult brewing in the Muslim world. This global jihadist frenzy that we observe whenever, really on a daily basis, but conspicuously in irrational ways, like, you know, when someone draws a cartoon of the Prophet and it gets published in a Danish newspaper, you can literally get crowds of 10,000, 100,000 Muslims calling for the deaths of newspaper editors. I mean, this is a deal breaker. This is not behavior that we should be apologizing for or accommodating. And, you know, the Pope, I think, was wrong to say what he said the way he said it. It was ridiculous to quote a 14th century emperor and inflame the Muslim world in that way. But he's right about the basic fact that jihad and the doctrine of martyrdom are current within Islam, central to Islam, and terrifyingly maladaptive. They really are getting people to blow themselves up with the expectation of eternal reward. And It's not just poor, illiterate people. In fact, it's by and large more educated and more affluent Muslims who are the most radicalized. And so we just have to start talking honestly about the logical consequences of this theology.
You know, I was struck by the passages from the Quran that you excerpted in your book, The End of Faith, over five pages back to back of nothing but excerpts, all of which vilify non-believers. I mean, the Islam God says in no uncertain terms in the Quran that the truly faithful should seek out, kill, and destroy those who do not believe as they do.
Right, right. And, you know, there are various loopholes that moderate Muslims use to pull the brakes on all of that. I mean, you can say, as many do, that, you know, these calls to jihad were applied only to that period in history where Muhammad and his followers were fighting against their infidel neighbors, and they don't apply now. And to read it as eternally relevant is a misreading of the theology. And then you can split other hairs. You can say that you know you can't kill non-combatants, and then the devil is in the details of how you define non-combatants. But the reality is that this book, the Quran, and the larger literature, the Hadith, make a few things perfectly clear. One is that God hates infidels. God hates non-believers. He wants nothing more than to mock and curse and shame and destroy and torture them for eternity after they die. He counsels his followers, that is true Muslims, to despise unbelievers, not befriend them, to politically subjugate them, and to kill them whenever their faith comes under assault. And assault can be defined as liberally as a cartoon drawing. So it is difficult. We need moderate Muslims to stand up and say Osama bin Laden has perverted the true teachings of Islam. I mean, we do need that at some level because we have to find some way of moderating the Muslim world or getting it to moderate itself. But the reality is that when people do this, they are also denying the true complexion of Islam, which is one which accepts jihad and martyrdom as legitimate principles of the faith.
And, of course, in the West, we've had a similar tradition. Anybody who's read Leviticus understands mm-hmm. where I'm going with this. I mean, can you talk about that as well? But we've had a stronger secular tradition that has learned to cherry-pick a lot quicker than the Muslim world has.
Yeah, well, one thing is just that we can recognize that Christianity and Judaism are at different moments in their history than Islam. They have suffered 200 years of confrontation with science and secular politics in a way that Islam hasn't, and therefore they have been moderated. You know, nobody is practicing Christianity the way most Christians were practicing it in the 14th century. It's just we're not burning heretics alive for their bad beliefs, and that's a good thing. And what we should credit is not Christianity for that. We should credit the moderating influence of the human conversation that has moved on from medievalism and that medieval adherence to religious dogma. So the truth is that even fundamentalists in our own society are not as fundamentalist as they might be, and they too cherry-pick the book. And, you know, while they believe many things that I think are quite dangerous, I mean, I think the belief that Jesus is going to come back in your lifetime and rapture you and everyone else into the sky so that you can witness a holy genocide that's going to end human history, I think that belief is quite dangerous and quite incompatible with developing a sane policy for a durable civilization. And we don't want presidents to believe this. I mean, it would be disastrous, and we're liable to elect presidents who do believe that. So all of that is of great concern, but we have to recognize that in Islam, it's as though we're confronting the Christians of the 14th century. I mean, we really are confronting whole populations who are absolutely deranged by their religious beliefs, and there is no tradition of self-criticism in their media, in their literature. I mean, it's just not there, and we have to talk honestly about it.
Our guest this hour is Sam Harris. His latest book is Letter to a Christian Nation. Let's take a quick break. We're back in two. This is Charlottesville Right Now.
This week, you'll find Kroger's fresh produce at unbeatable 10 for 10 savings.
Like
ripe sweet cantaloupe, 12-ounce bags of Dole Greener Selection salad mix, 1-pound bags of Kroger radishes, and 3-pound bags of yellow cooking onions. All are 10 for 10 with your Kroger Plus card. Oh, and delicious black seedless grapes are 10 pounds for $10.
What else is 10 for 10?
Plenty. Now through Saturday, you can find more than 200 10 for 10 sale items. Just look for all the orange 10 for 10 sale tags. In the meat department, you'll find 6-ounce packages of Hillshire Farms Deli Select Lunch Meats, 7-ounce...
Finally, you will get the opportunity to speak your mind about the issues that are affecting all of us.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
With historian and best-selling author, Coy Barefoot.
10 minutes before 5 o'clock here in Central Virginia. Best Seat in the House starts at 5 o'clock, right after CBS News at the top of the hour. A special Best Seat. We're all getting ready for Albemarle versus Charlottesville tonight, and you'll get play-by-play coverage right here on News Radio 1070 WINA. Sam Harris has been our guest this hour. He's the author of the national bestseller, The End of Faith, Religion, Terror, and the Future of Reason. His latest book is Letter to a Christian Nation. Sam, what has surprised you most on this journey that you've taken as, you went to college and you have studied religions around the world for over 20 years. And as you are writing these books and promoting these books and having this discussion with people, what has surprised you most?
That's a good question. There are many features of this debate that I find continually astonishing. One is just how strange our situation is, and how we lose sight of its strangeness. I mean, it really is so strange that it is almost impossible to keep its strangeness vividly present. It's as strange as if, we were living in a world where millions and millions of people were organizing their lives around the plays of Shakespeare and fighting wars over rival interpretations of these plays. I mean, we are being deranged by ancient literature, and it's just an impossibly bizarre misuse of our opportunities here. It's just, you wouldn't believe it were possible but for the fact that it is actually occurring. And so that is, I mean, even for myself, someone who spends most of his time thinking about how religion is undercutting sane human practices and social policy, and how it's blocking medical research and leading unnecessarily to human conflict, it's still, I continually just wake up and occasionally, freshly realize just how bizarre our situation is. And it's so bizarre, it's almost impossible for someone who's spending his full-time preoccupation on it to keep that strangeness in view.
If your argument that your view is reality and based on reason, why is it, especially in the West, when we've had hundreds of years of, I would be remiss here in Charlottesville if I didn't mention Mr. Jefferson, who made this argument so clearly,
right.
So clearly, and was heard by so many people when he made this argument. Which was even, let's admit it, it was even more courageous for him in the 18th century mm-hmm. than it is for somebody today. Why is it then, if we are talking about reason, that it still flies into the face of 87% of Americans who just think it's just beyond crazy not to believe these things?
Yeah. Well, it's been, I think, largely because religion has seemed like the only game in town when you have to talk about the meaning of life and the profound moments in life, like death and birth and marriage, when you need to invoke ritual to mark occasions that deserve something more than ordinary conversation. We have this need for profundity, and in the West, we have not developed a rational language with which to meet that need. I think we could easily do that. I mean, there's no reason that you need to believe anything on insufficient evidence in order to recognize that our circumstance is profound. I mean, we are embedded in a just shockingly vast and inscrutable circumstance, this cosmos of ours, and insofar as we have understood it scientifically, its profundity increases. It's not that it gets trivialized by scientific insight. And also, we have the capacity personally, subjectively, to transform our experience of the world through various practices, whether meditation or, you know, other disciplines, where we can really transform ourselves, and neuroscientists are beginning to study these transformations in people with various techniques of functional neuroimaging. You're studying monks who have done years of meditation, for instance. I mean, the human experience is plastic in a way, and it can be changed through, you know, how we pay attention to our lives and how we think. And religion traditionally has kind of been the only domain in which these experiences have been captured, and they've been captured in dogmatic, metaphysical language for the most part. And so, you know, we have to pull out, you know, the diamonds in the rough from our contemplative traditions and talk about these possibilities rationally. And we haven't done much of that.
At the end of the day, what is it that you want most people to that you want people to understand most, or perhaps think about most?
Well, I think that, you know, if you read the newspaper and look at the news and you keep in mind the question, what does religion have to do with this? I mean, when you see, you know, for instance, that the president has just used his first veto to block stem cell research, you just contemplate the fact that, you know, the tens of millions of people are suffering unnecessarily on the basis of this. I mean, there are literally tens of millions of people suffering diseases that for which stem cell research is the best course of research, and we're not funding it at the federal level because there's this belief that your souls can eternal souls can exist in a petri dish, and this is a dogma for which there is no really good argument, and yet we never even have a public conversation about this because the religious belief that stands in for ethical argument here has to be respected. And so I would just advocate that people begin to keep asking this question, you know, how is false certainty affecting public policy? How are people pretending to know things they clearly can't know? And how is this escaping criticism? And then you will see it everywhere. I mean, there are days literally where half the news is religious news, and it's not being acknowledged as such.
Sam Harris, award-winning and best-selling author, his books The End of Faith, and most recently, Letter to a Christian Nation. Sam, it's been an honor to speak with you, and I want to thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it's been a great pleasure, Coy. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. That's Sam Harris, and I would encourage folks to read this book, especially the most devout believers among you. These are important books, and these are ideas that should be discussed. On Monday, we'll have Bob Gibson of the Charlottesville Daily Progress for an update on the Senate race between George Allen and Jim Webb. We'll also speak with Gary Nordlinger, one of the top media consultants. He's worked on over 500 political campaigns in 18 countries and 4 continents, and he's consistently ranked as one of the top political consultants in the world. Gary Nordlinger, our guest on Monday. Y'all have a great night.
Football season is here, and so is Volvo's 2007 starting lineup. Only...
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SevillePodcast.com for more.